Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Risky Business. This week's podcast is brought to you by Microsoft. In case you haven't heard of Microsoft, they're a little niche player in the software market based in Redmond, Washington. We've got a great show prepared this week. We'll be analysing reports of the death of WPA with wireless expert and assurance.com.au consultant Neil Wise. You may have seen some news articles over the last week that claimed WPA was broken. And this isn't really the case, but there have been some issues uncovered, and Neil will be along soon to discuss them and what they mean to your business. Suffice to say, they are significant issues, but WPA hasn't been cracked like WEP was. We'll also be joined later on by Peter Watson from Microsoft in this week's sponsor interview. Peter heads up all things security in Australia for Microsoft, and he also heads up software as a service. And Microsoft is aggressively ramping up its cloud services. You'll hear Peter and I have a bit of a riff around software as a service, and it's not necessarily a discussion purely about security of cloud services or the security of cloud services. But at the end of the day, it'll be InfoSec teams who have to manage any risks associated with cloud services. So I figured it was a good interview, and that one's coming up later. Also, don't forget, RuxCon is coming up. That's Sydney's security conference or hacker conference, whatever you want to call it. And you don't want to miss it. The conference takes place in the last weekend of November, and you should really go to ruxcon.org.au to pre-register, or you could miss out. It's only $60 paid at the door, and it's a great event. So help the organisers out and go to ruxcon.org.au to register and check out the schedule. But let's get on with it now, and it's time for a check of the last week's news headlines with Adam Metalstorm Boileau, who's filling in for ZDNet Australia's Munir Kataria. And Adam, an online prescriptions company called Express Scripts has been hacked, and the crooks who stole their database threatened to release the information publicly unless Express Scripts paid them extortion money. But instead of paying, they've gone public about the breach.
Well, it'll be interesting to see whether they follow through, given the company is now not paid up their extortion demand. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they follow through.
And apparently the only reason they actually found out about the breach in the first place is because the guys who stole the data tried to shake them down and to extort money from them. So it is an interesting approach that they've taken, which is to go, well, screw you, we're just going to come clean to the public rather than pay you guys.
Yeah, well, I guess it's a bit of a weird model, you know, trying to extort people over data theft, because you have no way of you know, proving that you've given the data back, you know, versus, say, extorting for denial of service, which, you know, you can stop the DOS or something.
I wouldn't exactly believe the bunch of criminals that they're going to destroy all copies of the data once you've given them the money. You know, I mean, there's no way to verify that. So I guess, you know, it's really hard to say that these guys have done anything but the right thing here, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that probably is the best thing to do. I suppose the best thing is not to get owned in the first place, dumbasses.
That's true.
Yeah.
Now, this next story, Adam, is probably the most hilarious security cluster that we've seen in quite a while. Would you explain what it is?
Okay, so apparently the Google Android phone, right, with the iPhone killer, the, you know, the crowning jewel of Google's mobile strategy, blah blah. Yeah. So you boot it up, and you go about your business, and it happily sends everything you type to the shell as root in the background.
Yeah. So if you type reboot enter, it reboots.
It reboots your phone, and if you type rmrs/ in your text message,
goodbye,
it RMRFs your phone. I'm like, well, seriously, I mean, it's hilarious. It's hilarious.
It is. It's genuinely funny. And Google's always sort of been a bit snooty about how technically superior they are to everyone else in the marketplace. And then they do this. I mean, it has been fixed. I believe it was fixed before this was even reported. But I mean, this is just such a colossal disaster, isn't it?
Well, it does say something about the, you know, the extent of their testing, you know.
There's been mixed reports about which particular hardware, firmware versions this affects. But, the later firmware is definitely taken care of. And it only affects some functions of the phone. So I've heard that if you're in the browser, it doesn't work. But if you're in the messaging window, it does. But, yeah, anything you type. So if you're typing a message to a friend and you happen to include a command, enter, you know, it's actually going to execute it. That's just, it makes me wonder how the device actually worked in the first place if everything's going to be executed as a command. You'd think that...
It does. And I suppose, you know, building embedded systems like that is, you know, when it gets down to it, there's usually one guy who's doing that particular bit of it because it's such low-level stuff, you know, it's not something the app developers care about. And I've built embedded systems and I've done dumb stuff like that because you don't have any real peer review when you're working down that low on an embedded platform.
Yeah.
So you can see how it happens, but still, I mean, what a joke.
Yeah, pretty much. I think if there was an award for the biggest boneheaded security fuck up for this year, it would have to go to Google for this one. I mean,
yeah,
I'm struggling. I mean, the Debian keys thing, I mean, this is actually worse. Like, it's not more serious. It's definitely not more serious, but this is worse in terms of pure boneheadedness.
Yeah, now this is definitely gets you my retarded security hole of the year award.
Excellent. We'll just mention this in brief, I guess, because it's not exactly revolutionary, but, you know, the old Hotmail scam where, you know, someone would compromise a Hotmail account and then look at who they correspond with regularly and then all of a sudden start sending them emails going, I'm in Nigeria and I need $500 to book a flight home because I got robbed and blah, blah, blah. It's an old scam. Looks like it's starting to pop up now on the social networking sites, which is inevitable, but
I mean, it's the perfect environment for this sort of thing. You've got all the information that you need to, you know, accurately tune your attacks.
Exactly. And there's that pre-existing trusted relationship. And yeah, I mean, it's not really a huge surprise, is it?
Well, it's what Facebook's for, right? It's the CIA's tool for doing this themselves.
Yeah, right. You know, the old, what is it? InQtel connection. We actually had the chief security officer of InQtel, Dan Gear, on the show a few weeks ago, which was a very interesting and illuminating 20 minutes, let me tell you. So yes, on Friday, Sydney sider Karina Wells received a Facebook message from one of her friends, Adrian, saying he was stranded in Lagos, Nigeria, and needed her to lend him $500 for a ticket home, but she knew it was sus. So
this is the point where she phones a friend, Adrian, and goes, oh, hi, what are you doing in Lagos, man?
Yeah. Yes. I don't think it really worked out for the scammers in that instance. Now, this is a great example of the Australian Federal Police doing their best to secure our information here in Australia. One of their operatives in Nepal left a whole bunch of documents on a hotel computer after he'd pulled them off a USB stick.
This is appalling. I mean, seriously, did they not teach them anything in their, you know, a federal police school?
Yeah, I mean, this is just unbelievable. What I found particularly interesting about it is there were documents left on the computers in the hotel's business center that included a copy of a 7-page document detailing priorities and strategies for the AFP's office in Bangladesh, including information about sharing intelligence with foreign agencies. I mean, this isn't the sort of stuff you want to just leave lying around on hotel computers.
Absolutely not. And I guess it does demonstrate one of the things that I realized when I first went to Black Hat, which is that the .gov, the .mil guys, you know, the police, law enforcement, they don't have any better handle on this stuff than we do, right? There isn't some magic government cabal that makes all their security problems better. Like, they have exactly the same problems that we do, and in many cases worse because they have more privileged information to worry about.
My God, sympathy for the feds coming from you. I did not see that coming.
Well, I suppose we do like our brothers from other mothers in the dot mill. I mean, they're just like short-haired versions of us, aren't they?
Short-haired versions, yeah, crew-cut versions of us. Yeah, so that was the AFP, and the guy has actually been recalled back to Australia, the agent responsible. So, yeah, pretty embarrassing.
For a sound spanking.
Yeah, pretty embarrassing all around for the AFP, which has suffered a bit of an image setback over some disastrous counterterrorism operations here in Australia. Now, this is a great story. Some software has been developed by some university students, some PhD students, which allows them to clone keys from photographs, and that's actual physical keys, like door keys and whatnot. That's a fascinating story.
Yeah, no, this is it's one of these things that, you know, once you think about it, you think, well, of course, right? This absolutely makes sense. But I suppose automating the process is interesting.
I can think of a couple of organizations that might actually benefit from that.
Well, Diebold, for example, might benefit from not putting pictures of the keys of their election machines online.
Yeah, they did that, didn't they?
Yeah, they did that. I think it was a couple of years ago now.
Yeah.
You could buy replacement keys for their machines in their web store, and they had pictures of the actual keys. Did actually make a key from a picture, and yes, it worked.
But you could have just, I mean, if they sell them online, couldn't you just buy them as well?
Well, absolutely. But I think they were restricting the sale to, you know, authorized people who'd already bought machines or had support contracts or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in this particular case, a guy actually made one and it worked. But yeah. Automating the process obviously is a big big improvement.
Well, what I find interesting about this is that this technology is in the public domain now, but I'm sure it's been around for quite a while. I mean, you can imagine organisations like your three-letter agencies and stuff in the US, like the CIA and whatnot. I mean, you can imagine how handy that sort of technology would be to them. Telephoto lens. I mean, these guys, this is the thing that I find stunning in this research. They actually used a camera fitted with a telephoto lens to photograph and duplicate a set of keys on a cafe table from a distance of 60 metres.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that is definitely weaponizing the attack, right? And that's a very, very useful thing to be able to do.
Yeah, especially if you're a burglar or a spook. So interesting stuff. Not technically an InfoSec story, but an interesting one nonetheless. Adam, that's going to take us to the end of the news. Thank you very much for joining us again this week.
And thank you, Pat.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there. Adam's the organiser of the KiwiCon security conference in New Zealand, as well as a freelance security consultant and developer. And we'll be back in 30 seconds.
Have email outages stopped your organisation stone dead? MessageLab's email continuity keeps your users working during email outages. MessageLab's offers on-demand email backup that kicks in seamlessly when things go wrong. If your mail server throws a disk or pops a power supply, your users fail over automatically to our backup systems. Find out more at messagelabs.com.au.
It's time now for this week's special feature with assurance.com.au's Neil Wise. Now, when I first saw reports surfacing of the demise of WPA, I got in touch with Neil to get the skinny. And while rumours of the death of WPA have been greatly exaggerated, there is certainly cause for concern here. The reporting around this has been pretty woeful, though. I guess to increase the likelihood of their pieces hitting Slashdot, some journalists just started spinning all sorts of bullshit about WPA being completely broken. There were headlines like, researchers cracked WPA and WPA hacked, doing the rounds, and it was made all the more curious considering the guys who've actually done the research, Eric Tews and Martin Beck, who are actually due to present their research in the next couple of days at PAXSEC in Japan. Well, they haven't really claimed any such thing. In fact, it seems like they've been pretty busy pouring cold water on the early reports ever since they broke. In an email to one journalist, they wrote that WPA is not completely compromised. The attack only allows decryption in a rate of 1 byte of plain text per minute, and the rate of packets which could be sent, that is injected into the network, is similarly low, like 1 to 4 packets per minute. And we'll get some more details on the bug in just a minute. It's interesting research, but hardly a death blow. It only affects WPA TKIP and doesn't affect WPA with AES encryption or WPA2. Still, we thought we'd have a look at the issue a little more deeply and ask Neil Wise, our next guest, if it's time to get busy upgrading to WPA2 or WPA with AES and what the pitfalls in such an upgrade are likely to be. So, Neil, for starters, is this a big deal?
It is a big deal in the sense that it's opening the door on a new area of research in wireless security, although at the same time, too, it's sort of looking back through the door at some old issues with related wireless security. The issue has a lot in common with some attacks that were conducted against WEP. In fact, it uses a modified implementation of the chop-chop attacks on WEP to sort of further its aims. But they're certainly right in saying that it is a somewhat rate-limited attack in that it has to work within some of the controls that were introduced into TKIP as part of the band-aiding of WEP that only a way to send a certain number of types of packets within a certain period of time.
Okay, so what does this research do in terms of opening up new types of attacks? What can the bad guys do with this stuff?
Well, what can actually be used is if there are certain conditions for the attack to actually be successful. They're not that unrealistic, although it is a little bit of a gamed situation in order to achieve the attack. It expects a certain facility to be supported from the wireless environment, namely the 802.11e quality of service features, which are used for supporting streaming media types. It requires a long rekeying value to be set on what they call the group keys, and this applies to WEP and to TKIP that are used for multicast and broadcast packets. And it requires conditionals that we set up in enterprise networks, rotate those key values for the shared group keys to not be in place. So if they are able to successfully achieve this attack, if the environment that they're attacking meets the, all the conditions that have to be in place for this particular attack to occur, because of the fact that you can only inject small amounts of traffic, about the best that you could do would be to inject gratuitous ARPs to try to drive traffic out of the wireless environment to a network that the attacker actually does control, or an endpoint such as on the internet. You know, so it's something that's it's tiny, but it's opening the door. It's sort of peeking under the covers of the crypto that's sitting in TKIP. I guess part of the issue with this is that TKIP turned up as a band-aid way of allowing us to deal with issues with WEP, basically, without having to go out and buy new hardware.
Now, TKIP is, of course, this, what is it, temporal key integrity, oh, something. What does it stand for again?
It's temporal key integrity protocol.
Oh, my God, I actually had that right.
Yeah, you're right. And TKIP uses RC4, which is what was in WEP as well.
But it just it rotates the keys, doesn't it? So really, WPA with TKIP is just like modified, you know, it's just like WEP, but changed up.
It's changed up. It has a couple of controls to deal with some major issues with WEP related to sequence checking and replay.
And of course, it's TKIP that's been broken. Now, a lot of people use WPA with AES. Now, that's not susceptible to these attacks, is it? Because, I mean, unlike, you know, using crappy old RC4, which is, you know, really, yay, RC4, it uses AES, which is a much more robust algorithm. Would you recommend that people out there start switching from using TKIP to using AES?
If they can, and this is where that the reason why TKIP was even implemented was the fact that it allowed us to update some, you know, the driver or maybe the firmware on a card, and to still to operate that in a slightly more secure manner than WEP. I mean, obviously, it's been good to this point. I would recommend that people try to migrate to this, but often for wireless, the issue we have is what I call a lowest common denominator situation, that you have to support what your devices are willing to support. And if you control the endpoint devices, so you control your notebooks or whatever that you have in your fleet, then you have the opportunity to obviously to refresh hardware or to modify the configuration of the devices to potentially support WPA AES instead of WPA TKIP. But if you don't, so for example, schools, universities, and so on, where they provide services, but the client system is owned by the end user, getting them to move up in hardware or in software configuration is obviously challenging.
And of course, WPA2 is a whole new level of headache when it comes to talking about upgrading, isn't it?
It is, but if you've bought a device in the last 2 or 3 years, it probably supports WPA2, and you should be operating that anyway.
So it's not actually that bad.
No, I mean, like the primary issues with WPA and WPA2 are just in the way that the initial handshake occurs. That's the primary differences between the two. But most devices, most, you know, contemporary devices, as far as notebooks and handhelds, support WPA2. For me, my issue is that I've got a lot of logistics customers who, you know, have warehouses full of these devices that sit in place for a number of years, and we were lucky to have WEP, let alone, you know, TKIP, WPA support, and so on. So the crypto moves on, and, you know, those devices stay behind.
Now, you reckon that because there have been some chinks in the armor, so to speak, now that the petticoat on TKIP has been lifted, there's going to be a lot more research, and you would anticipate from, you know, conversations we've had prior to this interview, that we're going to see some more action in this space. Is that correct?
Of course. There's always, like, wireless is just a continual moving target. So, you know, I'm sure that there's other research that's going on in this space. I mean, this attack really is more revealing some of the inherited issues that come with the RC4 turn to TKIP sort of implementations in this. But I think that this is waving a red flag at the community, and I think that this will spur on a lot of other research. Certainly in trying to implement this attack myself, I've had a lot more of a look at this area, and there's just a lot that goes on here, and there's probably greater opportunity to further attack this. So certainly when you get the cryptologists like these guys here, it's certainly an area that is mathematically interesting. Their paper is really good. Like it's very interesting because it also talks about the history of attacks in this space as well. So I think it's a good entry point for people who are sort of looking to start here and then run forward.
I got to ask, Neil, what did you think of the reporting of this issue? Because it struck me as being particularly woeful.
Well, I think the part of that comes from the fact that initially there was the information that this was going to be talked about, but the paper wasn't released. So I think that there was a lot of reporting going on, the presumption that this was going to be another just gigantic Achilles heel issue. And so I think that in reading the paper, they certainly lay out reasonably what the exposure is and how it can actually be used. So I think that it was just the fact that it was early reporting, and I think that now if reporting is done based off of reading the research, I think that it would be different. I would hope so. But it may also just be, as you say, to get sort of eyes on, flashed out on people. So, yeah.
So I guess the message is, if you can upgrade to WPA with AES, go forth and do it. And if you can't, start looking at ways to, I suppose, lock down your wireless network even further and make sure there's nothing sensitive carried on it?
Well, I mean, that should be your first concern with any kind of, you know, perimeter-based services. I mean, you know, but getting people to do that is always a challenge.
And I think also the relative strength of WPA up to this point has made people a little bit complacent. I don't know if you agree with that, but...
I think so. I think there's a presumption that because it addresses the obvious issues with WEP in the way that, like, for example, with WEP, with a password on WEP, that was trusted both for authentication and encryption, and WPA is different in that sense, in that there's a bit more negotiation going on. I think that there has been some complacency, and I think that's part of why that there hasn't been as much research into this, that there's been a presumption that because it treats these issues that, you know, it sort of makes things better for us all. But I think that for what I recommend people certainly to do is start looking at WPA2 with AES. You really should be looking at, where possible, proper EAP methods in 802.1x in wireless. But for the home user, you know, most people don't run a radio server at home, so it's not something that's as easy an option. Never trust your wireless network. You know, control the traffic going in and out of it, least privilege, yada, yada. So.
Neil Wise from assurance.com.au, thank you very much for speaking to Risky Business.
And thank you.
Neil Wise from assurance.com.au on the line from Melbourne there. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now. Each week we let our sponsors come onto the show to discuss a hot topic. Last week it was Greg Singh from RSA talking about smart cards and USB smart cards. And this week Microsoft is our sponsor, so we'll be chatting shortly to Microsoft's Manager of Platform Strategy, Peter Watson. That job title means he covers security as well as software as a service, or cloud services, for Microsoft here in Australia. And as listeners to last week's show would have heard, the entire IT world has suddenly gone crazy over cloud computing. In fact, I just got a fresh press release today from EMC touting their latest cloud services. Now, that could have something to do with Microsoft's decision to make a major play for the space. They're going after the online CRM market, which is currently cornered by Salesforce.com, and even Microsoft Office is set to go online. It's going to be the job of security professionals to work out what sort of data can be used in the cloud and which vendors are kosher to deal with. To have a discussion around cloud computing, we're joined now by Microsoft's Peter Watson. Peter, the cloud talk seems to be everywhere all of a sudden. What's your take on this?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's a sudden obsession. Microsoft's definitely been playing in delivering services in the cloud for quite a while, especially in the consumer space. If you look at what we've been doing around Live, MSN, and especially, you know, sort of in the gaming area, it's something that Microsoft's been doing for a while. But now we're definitely moving into recognizing that organizations are looking at how can they get software plus services through using a cloud infrastructure as well.
Now, how much of this stuff do you think is actually hype? You know, I can just see, I think we discussed it on last week's show, where we could see, you know, some CIO asking a vendor if they had cloud.
I think there's still a lot of hype around, you know, is this going to be a revolution and totally change how IT is going to operate? So I think from our point of view, it's more a evolution versus revolution. And I think that's where it's really going to play out. What we're seeing at the moment is most organizations are looking for a cloud-based solution, but are really looking at in terms of how do they evolve their existing applications to take advantage of the internet. So looking at, you know, what are some of the sort of more commodity type applications, such as email, such as, you know, some of the SharePoint applications? How can they leverage their cloud infrastructure to do that?
Well, it could be a slow-burning revolution too. I mean, who knows where it's all going to be in 10 years?
Look, and I think that's right, and I think it's going to take time for people to sort of fully understand what does this actually mean? What does it mean from what do you want to run on-premise and what do you want to run in the cloud?
Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of talk around, you know, security concerns when it comes to services in the cloud. I mean, what do you say to people who are concerned about putting enterprise data into your hands?
I think that ties back to our comment earlier about the evolution. We do see that there's still a lot of work to be done, that organisations really need to understand what's the value of the data. And so I think it's interesting, you know, one of the reasons why sort of people sort of said, well, why is the security guy now taking on software plus services?
Mm.
If you look at some of the key characteristics of what organisations are going to need, it's going to be around how do I do the identity right? How do I get privacy right? You know, how do I get the security around that data right before I am going to say, yeah, I will be willing to put some of my data up in the cloud.
Before, yeah, you're willing to store evil plan to take over the world .xls on one of Microsoft's servers.
Correct. So it's really working with organisations. Organisations do need to sort of really assess, you know, what data do they want to store on-premise? What's really critical for them that they don't really want to, you know, have in terms of being able to have accessible globally from being able to access from the cloud? But what are some of the business functions that they say, hey, this makes sense to actually do it? So I think, you know, the security community's got a big role to play in this whole software plus services and cloud opportunity, because organisations really, I don't think, understand, you know, what is the value of their data? What do they want to store on-premise? What are they willing to actually move into that sort of collaborative framework by putting it up in the cloud?
Mm-hmm. Now, I suppose you guys will be very eager to make sure there are no screw-ups as far as the security of these services are concerned. I mean, what sort of steps have been taken in the development phase to make sure that this stuff is locked down pretty tight? Because we all remember what happened with Passport, you know?
So one of the things we've done, we've leveraged a lot of, I suppose, the learnings that we have had around our live infrastructure, around our MSN infrastructure in terms of putting that in play. We've also leveraged a lot of the security capabilities that we have built into the existing application. So looking at, you know, the offerings that we are putting up into the cloud are really leveraging, you know, a lot of the learnings and the capabilities that have been built into those applications that organisations traditionally run on-premise. But it is really sitting down with organisations and doing that, you know, data analysis to say, you know, what's the value of your information? How are you going to tag that? How are you going to work out where you're actually going to store it? Is it going to be 100% foolproof? Nothing's ever 100% foolproof. But it's really, again, going back to the basics of, you know, doing that threat risk assessment, understanding the value of the data, working out, you know, where's the right location to actually put the information.
Okay, Peter Watson, we will let you get back to your 15-hour day. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Patrick. Thieves cut new wounds, soldiers banner songs, and rats don't flee, oh no. Close their eyes and shut, soldiers run in fear. Where have they been? Oh, hold their hands are tied, soldier act on faith, try not to fall now.
Microsoft's Peter Watson on the line from Sydney there. And that wraps up this week's show. Big thanks again to Microsoft and Message Labs for paying the bills. And the music you hear playing now is a song called Soldiers by Marshall and the Fro. And you can go check out tour dates and album and coffee mug sales, I guess, at marshallmusic.com.au. marshallmusic.com.au. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Cannot walk straight now, the tears are gonna be too short. I can't walk straight now, the tears gonna be too short.
continues. It goes on.